opportunity to gather, even though in person is always better. But this is great, and I really appreciate every one of you for continuing your commitment to the Public Health Advisory Council and being here for our meeting this evening. So we'll get right to it. We have a lot going on. So the first thing I'd like to do is introduce our newest FAC member. I'm very excited to introduce you all to Peggy Carlston, and we can see you, Peggy. And she is going to be our new educational community representative. And Peggy, if you would please share just a little bit about yourself and how you came to be interested in doing this.
Sure. Hi, everyone. Peggy Carlson. I work at the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction, which is our state education agency. And my job there is the foster care education program supervisor. What that means is I support all of the districts in the state in implementing state and federal law as it relates to students in foster care. Prior to OSPI, I worked for one of the big districts here in Vancouver. I live in Vancouver. I was the homeless liaison, so I supported students and families experiencing homelessness, and that's kind of where my heart has always been with these underserved communities like students in foster care, students experiencing homelessness. And I'm married to a teacher, and when I saw the FAC was looking for an education committee member, tried to get my husband to do it, and he wouldn't. So I'm excited to be here, and thanks for allowing me to join.
Well, thank you for joining us. We're glad to have you. So I'm going to go ahead and do the roll call now. We have a pretty tight agenda, but I would like to find out, Doreen's going to make sure we have a quorum. Are you able to tell yet, Doreen? We're good?
Yes, sorry, couldn't unmute. We definitely have a quorum, and there is one caller that I don't know who we have. The number is, 360-828-5156.
That's Paul.
Oh, Paul, okay.
Okay, good. Great. Okay, very good. All right. So, as I call your name, if you just please indicate that you're on Zoom or phone. And that way, if there's anybody else on the phone, we'll ask for that afterward. But hopefully, we'll just make sure that we've got everybody accounted for tonight. So, because we've had some new members lately, today I went ahead and pulled off a list of our membership from our website. And so, if you ever want to see or refresh your memory as to, who the folks are, especially new people getting used to who's who and what their role is, it's on the public health website. There's a place for the Public Health Advisory Council, and click on that, and one of the things that you can see is a membership. So I'm going to go right down the list. So here we go. Michelle Stickley.
Here.
Sandy Brown.
I'm here on Zoom.
Thank you. And we heard Paul Childers on the phone. Thank you. Mark Collier. I understand Remy is not available tonight. Adrian Fairbanks. Dave Fuller.
I'm here.
Thank you. Peggy Carlson, we just met her. Andy Santos.
Hello.
Hi, Andy. Shona Carter.
Hi, I'm here on Zoom. And it looks like Adrian Fairbanks is also on Zoom, maybe on mute.
Thank you. I didn't catch that. Thanks, Shona. Dr. Neville's also not able to attend this evening. John Brooks.
I'm here on Zoom.
Thank you. Stephanie Rosie Amashita. I don't see her. Tyler Clark.
Sorry, I'm on mute. And it's Stephanie Roisimasha. Yes, I'm on Zoom.
Oh, thank you. I need to make a note of that. I think I've gotten that wrong before. Sorry. And Tyler Clary.
Present on Zoom.
Thank you. And Maria Swinger-Inskeep.
Here.
Thank you. Cassandra Sellers, right? Kelsey? I saw her, but maybe not. Aru Hendrick?
I'm here.
Thank you. Dr. Melnick?
I'm here on Zoom.
Thanks. And Heather Decker?
I'm here on Zoom.
All right, as am I. Okay, then. Are there any guests that might have called in that I'm not aware of? Hearing none, we'll just continue on. First thing will be the formal approval of our previous meeting notes, and that would be from August 10th. Hopefully folks have had a chance to review them, and so, assuming so, I'll ask if we could have someone to make a motion that we approve the minutes.
I so move. Oh, I move to approve the minutes. Sorry, Sandy. Sorry, I jumped in there.
That's okay. Thank you. And a second? Or did we get that?
A second.
Okay. No. Thank you. Thank you. And so all in favor, say aye. And if you wish to say no, please do that after the ayes and state your name so we can get a fair count. All in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, please say no. Hearing none, the motion will be carried. And then next thing is I want to go briefly through the agenda so that we, folks who are on the phone, in case they don't have it in front of them, they'll see what is coming up next. And we do have a lot to cover tonight. So we'll have some department updates, and I'm going to list them and who's going to be presenting. So we'll have an environmental public health presentation on climate trends in Clark County, and that will be provided by Brian Schlottman and Alyssa Payne. And then I'll be presenting an update on what's been going on with the bylaws and the subcommittee update. We'll have a budget update and a foundational public health funding and staffing update from Jeff Harbison. Racial equity training update from Andrea Pruitt. And then a COVID-19, it's going to be a conversation with council members who will be asked to share barriers and issues that they're facing related to COVID-19. And Dr. Melnick will be presenting that, and then hopefully we'll all participate in that. And after that, we'll have the executive committee update, and we'll be talking about nominations for this next year. It seems like that comes around so quickly. And then that'll be the end of our conversation. We'll have I'll just remind us all that we have our next meeting on December 14th. And then format. Yes.
Can I ask, I think Jeff Harbison may need to leave early. I'm wondering whether he can go before the bylaws with the budget update, if we can move those.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. So, yeah, we'll do the budget update after the EPH. Wonderful. Thank you.
Okay, sounds good. Does he need to go before EPH?
Actually, if I could go first, that would be tremendous.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay, thank you very much. I apologize. Welcome.
Oh, no worries.
So budget update.
Before you go, Jeff, are the folks, listen, and Brian okay?
Yeah,
going second. I just want to make sure they don't have something to go to either.
Oh. Are
you okay with us?
Oh, no, that's... We're okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay,
thank
I'm sorry.
You. Thank you very much. I'm really sorry.
Oh, that's quite all right. No problem. I'm glad you let us know.
Okay.
Okay, let's see then. Then why don't we go ahead and I think we're actually, we have no public comment tonight, so let's go ahead with you, Jeff, and then you'll be able to get on your way.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Sure.
So our 2022 operating budget has been submitted. It is balanced. It is, the public hearing for us will be November 17th, which is a Tuesday. November 16th. November 15th is the first day for the public hearing, but that is for the elected departments, such as the Sheriff's Office, the Assessor, the Clerk, the Treasurer, Auditor, etc. We have quite a few new funding sources for the 2022 budget. Collectively, we have 29.15 more FTE in the 2022 budget than when we began the 2021 fiscal year. Yes, it's fantastic. 6.75 FTE were added as part of the 2022 budget, basically with revenue updates, existing revenue updates, and 3.0 positions were added via the American Rescue Plan Act. Those are all project positions, but they are positions we're adding. We were also able to add 3 positions with enhanced federal STD grant funding. And last but not least, we're adding 16.4 FTE using foundational public health services funding. So 29.15 total FTE increase 2022 compared to the beginning of 2021. Great news. I've been here a long time and seen a lot of reductions. I have yet to see an expansion of this size. And like I said, I've been here since 1998, so I've been here a while, and it's great to see. After years and years of funding difficulties for public health at the national, local, and state level, it's great to see this.
I say that deserves a round of applause. My goodness. That's terrific.
Thank you. I don't deserve the credit, but yeah. So 2 weeks from tomorrow, October 27th, the Board of Health will entertain an ordinance to update our 2022 environmental public health fee schedule. We had one-on-ones with the counselors as Board of Health, and we had a Board of Health work session as well. They provided their guidance. The guidance is to maintain 100% cost recovery in all programs except for drinking water and on-site septic permitting. In those two programs, we're going to be at a 90%, 10% cost recovery, 10% funded with county general fund dollars, 90% funded through fees. This is a policy decision by the Board of Health, and the 90-10 model is what we recommended as far as ongoing. So our policy recommendation, which they agreed with, is to maintain the 90-10 model for those programs. Those two programs are the most susceptible to economic downturns that affect construction. Those two programs were decimated in 2008 and 2009 with the economic downturn, where we basically didn't have funding to maintain any staff. There's plenty of greater good work that's necessary in those two programs, so having some funding to maintain some semblance of greater good services is imperative. So again, the Board of Health hearing on October 27th is when the 2022 EPHP ordinance will be heard. I think those are my two big topics, the 2022 budget and all of the new funding and positions and the environmental public health fees that come along with it. If there are any questions on the budget or the process, I can definitely field those now.
My only question is there anything that we can do as a FAC committee to support your efforts as you go forward to this meeting?
I see no indication since the ordinance we're bringing forward for fees is based on council guidance or Board of Health guidance. I don't anticipate any pushback, any difficulties getting those through. We met with the county manager regarding the 2022 budget. All of our change requests or decision packages are being recommended by the county manager. So I don't see a need for any support from FAC, although we greatly appreciate it, obviously. I'm sure there will be times in the future where we do need it. So thank you very much for that.
Yeah, we haven't gotten into the bylaws yet, but with the new role in FAC, based on the changes of 1152, I think we'll be bringing more budget information to FAC for review. And we can talk more about that when we talk about the bylaws. And that will be an opportunity to really, I think, enlist if there's some issues we need, FAC wants to support on in terms of budget. I think that will be an opportunity as well.
Yeah, I think it's one of the expectations of FAC is that we will be weighing in on some of these things. And I think they're things that we've done somewhat in the past. And I know we wrote a letter at one time about foundational public health, I think, anyway. So that's good. There's going to be some changes, and I think they'll be primarily very good.
And in terms of the areas, so the big ad is the Foundation of Public Health Services, just to remind folks that the legislature allocated, I think, $147 million, if I remember correctly, for Foundation of Public Health Services. And they're divided into, there's categorical areas like communicable disease control, environmental public health and assessment. And we're going to be adding positions in each of those areas. We're also going to be, Escamania County is going to be contracting with us. They're going to be sending us some of their FPHS allocation. And we're providing some regional communicable disease control and assessment services for Escamania County. And then we received an STD HIV grant. We'll be adding STD rates. Have been increasing for a number of years. Really, we're well behind in being able to address those. We'll be able to hire three community health workers for that program to do case investigation, contact tracing, that kind of work. And then I believe you all can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think on the ARPA funding, we have some funding for infection prevention staff as well. Given that will really help in terms of what we're dealing with COVID-19. I may have left some stuff off, but that just gives you a good idea of where we're going. I don't know if anybody on leadership team here for our department wants to add anything that I might have missed there.
Yeah, the three positions used funded with ARPA, they're all project, but yes, one of them is an infection prevention public health nurse, and then two of them are environmental health specialists supporting the food safety team.
Yeah, there was some backlog there, given the whole COVID situation. So we're going to catch up on that.
Jeff, could you tell me again what was that first? You were mentioning the environmental positions. Were there three of those? You said
no. There's multiple environmental health specialists. If you look at all funding sources, but with the American Rescue Plan Act or ARPA. There were two of them that were project, and they're called environmental health specialists. Mm-hmm. We've got five or six others added with foundational public health services funding, and those are not project positions. Those are regular operating positions.
The reason for the project positions is ARPA is one-time funding only, mm-hmm. and so those will be they'll be time-limited positions, but they're going to help us get make up the backlog in terms of some of the food safety programs.
And the foundational operating, what is that for?
So the foundational public health services, that's the grant funding source.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that source is from the state. So the legislature, so ARPA is federal. The STD HIV grant that we talked about was federal grant passed through to the state. STD rates are going up all across the country, hence that funding. And then the Foundational Public Health Services was the state, the legislature allocated. Public health in the state has been underfunded for years, so that's a state legislature allocation. And that went to every jurisdiction in the state.
Thank you for clarifying.
Now we want to make sure that we're really clear in what we're doing here. And the FPHS funding was really directed at, and we can give you an update at some point about, you know, what FPHS, what foundational public health services are, but they're basically the kind of services, public health services that really are kind of unique to both state and local government, like some of those environmental public health services, like food inspections, septic, drinking water, those kinds of things, and communicable disease control, like what we're doing with COVID, but other things as well. And then that assessment piece, community health improvement plans, community health assessments, those kinds of things that are bottle records is another foundational public health service, as well as communication as well. So there's a number of them that fit in the definition, and we can get those documents to you that describe what they are as well.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Jeff before he needs to leave us?
Thank you again for allowing me to go first. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for your report, and have a good rest of the evening. Thank you. Thank you. Well, then let's go on to the environmental public health presentation on climate trends in Clark County. And Brian and Elisa will take it away.
Yeah, thank you. Give me just a second to get set up and share the right screen.
Okay.
Let's see, can you all see my screen?
Yes.
Okay, all right, great. Well, I'm Brian. I am a program manager with Public Health, and I have Alyssa Payne here with me. She's an environmental health specialist that oversees the work done by our Swim Beach program, and that does the algae and coli monitoring. Climate trends is a relatively new topic for us to be presenting on, which is why we've developed this presentation as just a very high overview of just some of the trends we're seeing, some of the observations we're seeing here locally in Clark County. And before I start diving into it, we're going to be talking about extreme events that are occurring. And I want to make it clear in this that an extreme event doesn't always mean a natural disaster. But in this situation, we're referring more to the coping mechanism of the community that's experiencing it. And so as an example, the 100 degree days that we experienced just last summer, some parts of the country, that's normal for them. They're built, their infrastructure is designed to handle that. But us, here in the Pacific Northwest, it destroyed gardens, we lost crops, and it was quite devastating for a lot of people just trying to stay cool. So, next slide. Okay. Indicators for climate trends. These are what scientists are looking at. There's a number of variables within each of them they're using to track changes in climate. We won't be talking about all of those. We're going to be focusing on weather and climate and the ecosystem. And another thing we won't be going into, because this is a very high-level overview, this is a very complex topic, we won't be going into the influential factors that are really specific to that are making those changes occur in our climate. So I just want to be clear, you guys may have some questions about, you know, what's causing this, and there are certainly answers out there, and we hope to come back and talk about those one day, but we won't be diving into them tonight. So with that, I will hand it over to Alyssa that'll start going showing us some of those observations.
Thanks, Brian. So before we can discuss impacts Clark County residents are facing with our changing climate, we need to go over first how our climate is changing locally. One indicator that is changing are our daytime temperatures. Extreme summer heat in the Pacific Northwest is trending upwards, as shown here from this chart from NOAA. Daytime temperature extremes are defined as the top 10% of record hot temperatures for the area. For example, if you look at the year 2003, 100% of the Northwest experienced the hottest temperatures on record for those areas. Heat waves across the U.S. have occurred more often and lasted longer since the 1960s, and the Northwest is no different, but the most extreme heat wave on record being this last year, 2021, not shown on this chart. Next slide, please. Along with daytime temperatures, overnight temperatures are also increasing. This chart from NOAA shows overnight temperatures have increased by 2 degrees Fahrenheit in the last century in Clark County. This chart may be specific to Southwest Washington. However, the same trend is occurring across the Pacific Northwest. Next slide, please. Another indicator we will be discussing in depth are changes in extreme rainfall events. In Clark County, a heavy rain event is defined as 1.65 inches of rainfall within a 24-hour period. To put that into perspective, that's equivalent to 3% of our annual rainfall falling within a 24-hour period. This chart shows that across the Northwest, a greater than normal proportion of our total annual precipitation has come from these extreme single-day events. This results in periods of drought and then risks of flooding and overwhelming our stormwater treatment facilities during these extreme rain events. Next slide, please. With these changes, with these climate changes, there will be changes to our surface waters. The University of Washington's Northwest Climate Adaptation Science Center suggested in the Northwest will likely see increasing frequency and severity of drought. Changes to rain events and magnitude will result in heavy precipitation in the fall and winter months and then drought during the summer. However, the system is not cyclical or corrective. For example, the anticipated La Nina winter this year is estimated to not be enough to restore normal soil moisture to the most heavily impacted areas by this year's drought, according to Washington Department of Ecology. Next slide, please. Continuing with changes to surface water, the map you see notes all streams and rivers that have been placed on the 303D list for elevated temperatures, shown in red. Being on this list indicates that it's an impaired water, not meeting water quality standards, or don't fully support the beneficial use under their designation. I've narrowed the criteria on this list to only show temperature as the primary variable, but these streams and rivers may also be listed for other water quality parameters. Next slide, please. So the final surface water change I will be discussing with you are harmful algal blooms, or HAB events, as you saw in that first photo of our presentation. The ideal conditions for a bloom to form is sunlight, slow-moving water or warm water, and excess nutrients, primarily nitrogen and phosphorus. So what makes them more frequent and severe? Human impact, including nutrients from stormwater, around our homes and businesses, and increased sedimentation from human development and impervious surfaces results in increased nutrients entering our waterways. In addition to human development, these climate trends are expected to drive warming water temperatures, more days without clouds, creating ideal bloom conditions. An increasing frequency and intensity of precipitation will increase nutrient loading conditions of our local lakes. It's important to remember that blooms are not just a nuisance, but a hazard to animal and human health. This summer in Washington, unfortunately, 7 pet dogs died after encountering blooms along the Columbia River near the Tri-Cities and Little Spokane River. I'm going to hand it over to Brian to talk more about environmental and health impacts of these climate trends.
Thank you, Alyssa. So let us start talking about the impacts we'll see in the environment if these trends are continuing. I'll talk about salmon, because I think everybody cares about salmon. So salmon thrive in waters that are at or less than 64 degrees, and they start becoming stressed above 64 degrees, and at 70 degrees Fahrenheit is when they actually start to die. At Bonneville Dam, from 2010 to 2016, the average summertime temperature of those waters was 68 degrees. In the 1960s, the average temperature was 62. And some of the daytime high temperatures that we saw just last summer got up to 72 degrees, which, as I just mentioned, at or above 70 is when salmon start to die. With more intense storms and heavy rain events, we'll also start seeing impacts on our stormwater system. Before we go to the next slide, I'd just like to point out the picture on the bottom of the slide came from, it's a great picture, I love the detail. It came from the Kalix Tribe website, and they have a lot of great information on impacts that are having in our climate as well, on salmon. They focus on salmon quite a bit. So with the more extreme events, one of the areas that may be impacted is our bioswales. And a bioswale is the natural filtration system that we see in our neighborhoods that are made to filter stormwater. They're made up of primarily native vegetation. The majority of water that comes through these is from frequent small rain events. If we see larger events, as we expect to see, they could easily overwhelm the system, creating a number of problems and doing quite a bit of damage. Another area that we're concerned about is extreme heat events and the survival of the plants in the bioswales. Wildfires is obviously another area of concern. Now, here on the west side of the state, we're not as high of a risk as the east is. However, there is still an impact from smoke that we see, although we don't see smoke from every wildfire that happens. And typically, the wind direction is traveling from the west to east, which is why we don't see the impacts. But in 2020, we are all well aware of the smoke that settled on top of us for many days. That was due to an east to west wind, a low pressure system that kept the smoke here, dropped the smoke down, and then it followed by a low airflow, which the smoke just settled right on top of us. And we had some terrible air quality during that time. Another indicator that we look at is ground level ozone. The prime temperature for ozone formation is approaching 90 degrees up to 100 degrees. And after 100 degrees, we interestingly see ozone suppression, where ozone isn't forming quite as much. But we do see secondary aerosols that start forming at that, which also have a significant impact on air quality. For this indicator, prior to 2015, the local air quality was regularly rated as good and seldom ever reached moderate or unhealthy for sensitive groups. Unhealthy first appeared in our area in 2015, and then again in 2017 and 2018, in 2020. So you see a clear trend there. And typically, 90% of their days on record here in Clark County, your rate is good. In 2017 and 2020, the number of good days for the first time ever in these 2 years fell below 90%. And our worst days typically used to be in the wintertime when people are doing more wood burning and using their fireplaces, but that's now split to 50% in the winter and now 50% in the summertime. The next slide, we're going to go a little bit more into detail on wildfires. The first slide, our first chart we see here is the number of wildfires. And you think that's great news because you see a downward trend. And in fact, we do see a downward trend in the number of wildfires. I don't want to spend too much time on that because fires are getting larger and they're doing more damage. The chart below that is looking at the average number of fires, average acres burned per fire. Again, I don't want to focus on that. Let's go to the next slide where we really start seeing the trend. And this is total acres burned per year due to wildfires. You see that 2015 is the worst year we have. 2020, another terrible year. I don't have the data for 2021, but I can tell you that we're on record to be about level with 2020. So another terrible year, which will continue this trend. Not all fires create the same level of damage. Unfortunately, the more we see fires encroach in our urban areas, we see damage also increase. And there's a couple fires I'd like to talk about to demonstrate that. The Whitney fire that was in 2020 in Lincoln County, it was over 127,000 acres, and it damaged or destroyed 145 structures. 65 of those were homes. The Babb fire was also in 2020, it was in Spokane. It was only 15,000 acres, and it destroyed 228 structures, 125 of those being homes, and a significantly smaller fire. The U.S. Forest Service reports in the Pacific Northwest, our fire season is starting sooner and it's lasting longer. Health impacts, before I start going into these, I would like to point out that there will be some areas in the country that see some modest improvement, and this could be a rainfall increase where it's much dry, arid, conditions or reductions in cold-related morbidity and mortality. However, we measure climate trends typically on a global scale, and the negative impacts that it'll have on health far outweigh any benefits that we'll see. And here I'm only mentioning a couple of the health impacts, and if you consider different areas of the country, these will be different. And some areas will be more impacted than others. And it's important to note that the reason they're not felt equally across all demographics, ages, or communities is because of the distribution of health disparities and the ways we adapt to climate are not equally distributed amongst all communities. So wildfire smoke events, temperatures rising, and increased ground level ozone, we can expect to see increases in asthma rates, which would increase absenteeism from school, which would require parents to stay home, parents and caregivers to stay home to care for those kids. An example of this, in 2017, the Eagle Creek fire, asthma-related emergency department visits in Clark and Multnomah County both increased significantly as the air quality also worsened. Warmer conditions and shifts in the airstream also improves conditions for different vector-borne diseases to travel to our areas. And this is fleas, ticks, mosquitoes, and those carry West Nile or Lyme disease. Like I said, this is a very quick overview. There's a lot of information. There's a lot to unpack here. These are the sources we used. If you have questions or you're looking to get a little bit more information, these are great spaces to start with. I hope this has spurred some questions, maybe even a little concern. I will do my best to answer questions, but I do hope this is a topic we can continue. Public health in this realm is not the one to solve the problems. This is going to take the community, by definition, really to come together. County departments, public works, community development, and the community itself to recognize the issue and come up with solutions. Thank you, and I will take any questions if there are any.
Hello, I have one. So my biggest question right now is that since we're finally coming out of the COVID year, a lot of students are looking to do a lot more community service. Is there any way right now that that volunteer groups could like start getting more hands-on on this issue and do anything that could help? Because I know for me, I'm an officer in my school's environmental club, and I very much know that for my community at my school, we are definitely more than willing to help in any way.
That's great to hear. I'm happy to say, I'm sad to say, climate, these trends will affect every facet of society in some way. We in the Pacific Northwest are not going to feel the brunt of it, but there are still things we can do to mitigate how our environment's going to be touched. One program I'm thinking of is, I'm thinking of it because I love the name, it's called Poop Smart. It's out of Department of Health, Ecology, but it's specifically focused on reducing contaminants in the environment in our streams and rivers. There's different strategies they're doing to reduce pollution, what people can do in their backyards, and encouraging shading of our streams and rivers. The 303D list that Alyssa showed, there's some easy strategies that homeowners can do. Clark County's in a unique position that a lot of the land that you're looking at, where those rivers and streams are located, are privately owned. And so it's reaching out to community members that own those properties to plant trees and encourage that. But I know there are, I believe there's some volunteer opportunities around that. If you have a specific topic area, I could probably point you in a better direction. So feel free to shoot me an email if you wanted to look into that closer. I can connect you with some resources.
All right. Can you please drop your email in the chat have it there? Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for answering.
Thinking of especially high school students and volunteer work, especially if you're gearing up for your senior project and you need to get some volunteer hours. There is the Clark Public Utilities Stream Team. They're awesome. I see Marla shaking her head. They're really awesome. Basically, you wear rubber boots and you arm yourself with some gardening tools and you go out and you do stream rehabilitation in person on site on the weekends. They're really awesome. They offer different certifications. So Brian will definitely drop his email, and we'd love to send you some ideas for you and for your classmates.
Good. Thank you so much.
Hey, Brian. This is Roxanne. I have some questions. Do you have, and Alyssa, this question's for you too, some policy level things that might be happening either in the state or locally or at a national level that you feel would be well worth our looking into or keeping track of, things that we could help to support, things that we could help educate also our council about here locally as well as our state policymakers. Do you have any ideas around that?
That is a fantastic question. And it's a hard one for me to answer right now. I know the state of Washington is doing a lot of work around climate change. Additionally, University of Washington is doing a lot of research. I haven't seen it come to a head yet, really, with policy decisions that you can make. That's an area I hope that we can focus on as public health to take that next step and really bring groups together in our county to start looking at what are those specific strategies that need to happen for us to get to the next level.
I have a question, a follow-up question to that. What are the specific groups that you interact with locally? Are they nonprofit environmental justice organizations? I'm just curious, like, who do you interact with locally to either move, you know, policy or advocate for specific legislation in general?
To date, this has not been a prioritized topic. So who are we working with now? We're not. This is work that really needs to be pushed forward. Like I just said, the state agency, Department of Health and Ecology, are fantastic resources that are doing a lot of work towards this. We developed this presentation for our Board of Health as really an initial way to present this topic as something that's important to us. It it's, like I said, community. It's going to take a community prioritizing this, making this important to their constituents, the people that vote them into office. If this is a priority for the community, this will be a priority for them. And there's so many different areas to look at with climate change. And so I think we as public health need to come together, and with support of FAC, if you have ideas and communities that we can reach out to, this is going to be all of us coming together to talk about it. Janice, you have a question.
Thank you, Brian. It's really more of a comment. So some of you that have been on the Public Health Advisory Council for a very long time will remember that we had developed like an addendum to go to the planning, comprehensive planning document, and we called it the Growing Healthier Report. And it was looking at community planning through a public health lens. And one of our chapters was called climate change. And at the time, our counselors asked us to remove that chapter. They were not comfortable with us talking about climate change. Since that time, we've been looking for ways to try and lay the foundation for having the conversation about climate change, which Brian's presentation originally was called Climate Change. We said, well, is there another way we could say that? And it's really, we're trying to strategically, and I think Brian and Alyssa, you guys did an amazing job with this presentation. It's just, I'm really, really impressed. And this is the first presentation we're doing to council. We're also working with some community partners. Brian has done a lot of relationship building, like with the SWACA, Southwest
Clean Air Agency.
Yeah. And some of our other partners, other departments in the county, and we're trying to line up some presentations or conversations to have with our council where we slowly build on this idea and start to provide the data and the information they need that we can really strengthen the conversation, because what we don't want to do is shut them down and have them not want to have the conversation at all. And so Brian has bravely taken that first step, and Alyssa, to really start bringing this conversation. It's been hard with COVID. It's one of our priorities, but with COVID it's been hard because counselors really at this time aren't necessarily wanting to hear about climate trends, climate change. But anyways, I just wanted to give that background and say, this is an area that's really important to us, and we have to figure out a way to bring it forward to our policymakers in a way that they want to hear it and continue with the work. So thank you, Alyssa. Outstanding.
So just I put in the chat a link to the Growing Healthier report that we had done. The date was 2012. I think the FAC championed that report. I don't know. I haven't scrolled through it. I don't know if the climate change chapter is in there. But there's another number of other chapters that actually deal with a whole bunch of issues around environmental justice. And including things, you know, I would add, you know, food access, access to physical activity. There was climate change. So that was in that report. And if this is something that FAC, this topic is something that FAC is interested in, you did challenge that in the past. This is something, and we were working really closely with the planning department in Clark County at the time. So this is something that FAC is interested in. This is something that, you know, you can that you can move forward. So I just put that archive report in there so you can see what's been done before.
Yeah, I wasn't able to access it with this particular link. It said it was blocked or something.
Okay, so let me put another. I'm going to go to the main. If you go, this might work. If you go here and just go down to the 2012 Growing Healthier report, this link may work. So that's a shorter one.
Is it located on our, I know it's on the Public Health Department website probably.
Yeah. The link that I just put in there is from it, but I've gone through enough pages to get you to it, closer to it. So, Shauna, I don't know whether you try clicking on this one, but if you scroll down, it'll say 2000, it'll say Growing Healthier report. You can see some of the other reports as well. Sorry about that. First link didn't work.
I wonder if we could put that in the FAQ, in with the FAQ materials. That might make it easier for FAQ members to find it. But, you know, because once this meeting's over, then we won't be able to have access to that link, I don't think.
That was since 2012. They didn't want the verbiage of climate change.
So we had a board of commissioners, which also the board of health at that time, was not interested in moving that particular issue forward. That was around, this came out in 2012. That was around 2012, 2013. The board of health at that time did not want to move that forward. We had done a lot of work on this with the planning department. It was actually some of the stuff that went into the growing healthy report got into the county comprehensive plan. So it's a long story.
So just a little side note, I think this is funny, but I was at a conference several years after this report came out, and I ran into a commissioner in there. It was a commissioner at the time, and I said, just went up to him and said, can we say climate change yet? And he said, well, I wouldn't use those words yet, but try to start talking about it, and I'll try to get my fellow commissioners to listen.
I wondered if we could do something. When I hear things like this, it just compels me to want to think of, or to be told, I guess, informed, because I don't know the answer. What would be like the top three things that a typical Clark County resident could do? And what I'm thinking about specifically is, like, we get things from the water utility that set, you know, three ways you can save water, avoid wasting water, and from electrical, here's how to reduce your electrical waste. And is there something that we could do as a, you know, FAQ committee to help put together some kind of tool that the community could have that would give them something, some way to take action? Because I feel frantic about it, but I don't know what I can do about it. I don't want to waste my time doing the wrong thing. So that's what I'm thinking about.
I am going to plug into the chat. It's a Department of Health link. It's a number of different things you can do as an individual. Just know the hardest thing in public health is to change behavior. Mm-hmm. So with that caveat, I will share this.
Right.
Yeah.
I also think that our board of counselors do like to hear from the public and constituents. And oftentimes, you know, people are super busy and they don't have a, you know, they may not be as engaged in sort of the local political scene. And unless our counselors hear from the public that this is an important topic to them, and it should be for all of us, because we all share a water resource that is very, very tenuous at this point. And that's a shared resource that we have in this region. And if something happens with our aquifer, we're going to be in bad, bad shape here. So this should be an issue that is very concerning to everyone in this area. But so often we don't take the time to express how important that is to us, and that we want them to focus on climate change issues as a means of policy change. You know, and this is an environmental justice issue. And a lot of times, sometimes, you know, our counselors may not necessarily want to talk about that, because that might not be the popular thing to talk about. But the more and more they hear from the constituents and the public that this is important to us, the more they will be influenced to make some, you know, significant, some maybe not significant, but some changes. And so I think another thing that we can do as FAQ is not only work within our own networks. You know, you as a FAQ group could, you know, share that this is an important topic, but we can also make sure that we're sharing this with our networks and having our networks reach out, because it really is very, very important, and it is worth the time. And I know we're all busy, but this is a significant problem for our community. And it is upon us now. It is critical at this point.
Yes, I think this is where I see community groups and organizing, you know, in partnerships with these communities that are organizing. I see I see them coming into the space to be those constituents, those voices at the table that aren't typically heard from. So, I mean, I work at a foundation, so we are connected to these agencies sometimes, and lifting these issues up, I think, sometimes kind of pushes folks in the direction of seeing the importance of getting involved. So
if they don't want to use climate change, do they have a preference of verbiage? Or are we just not going to talk about it?
Climate trend?
Yeah, well, like, that's why the presentation...
Is that what the verbiage is?
But Mac can use whatever term you want to use. You're
okay.
Public Health Advisory Council. And I'd also point out that just like COVID-19 and every other threat to human health, this is an equity issue, and mm-hmm. some populations are differentially impacted by this. And that's an update that can be done to the Growing Healthy report as well. I mean, if you all wanted to take that on, so it's there. But there's other ways to take this on as well. But yeah,
I'm really blown away.
Brian and Elisa, when are you delivering your report to the Board of Health?
Last week.
Oh.
Darn. Yeah. Was, no.
Yeah.
Because one thing we could do is we could show up, you know, at these kinds of meetings as a show of force, I guess, or a show of support. Better way to
say that. I would say it was relatively well received. There wasn't pushback about the topic. There was some interest. It did follow a challenging public comment period, and so I'm not sure how engaged they were with it. I think it was a good first step.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, this is a good first step, and it's not just, you know, we presented this, you know, we're sort of easing into it and like, hey, let's talk about climate trends. And, you know, and they did a really good job about that, and that's excellent. But this is just sort of the first step. So there's going to be plenty of opportunity. And this is why we wanted to share this with you, because this is something critical. And it could very well be something that you all would want to take some more action around. So,
and I think the only other thing I would add is the words climate and change put together have become very politicized, right? And so, you know, they have constituents who don't believe or are fearful of what this could mean. Are they going to have to change their business? Is this going to cost me money? And so they, as politicians, are trying to be sensitive to their constituents. And so this also, if we can find another way to talk about it without using those two words, it also gives them a way to talk about it to their constituents with hopefully not shutting people down before the conversation starts.
By the way, in the old days, when we were doing this work, we were able to also do what are called health impact assessments. So when development was going to be done, we were able to actually do a public health analysis of that, what the health impact of that assessment was done. But the other thing that I take from this is the incredible parallels between this and COVID-19 and other things about the science around climate change, the way we talk about COVID-19, the way we talk about climate change, this will be there are strategies around this as well.
I think that's what we need to employ, because I know with the county councilors, and some of them more than others, stated very plainly that they take their direction from their constituents, not from the Public Health Advisory Council necessarily. So to the extent that I agree with everything Janice said too about understanding how to communicate in a way that it's not going to be off-putting, but actually try to build some bridge, you know, between stronger strengthen the relationship between Public Health Advisory Council and the counselors, so that it's not, doesn't feel like we're on opposite sides. And not all the counselors believe the same way. So I just think there's some work there that could really make a difference in terms of our ability to influence. And we do have a duty now based on the new law, HBR 1152, to there's many things that we must do that in the past we were not required to do. So maybe we should make a transition into the next topic, which is the bylaws. But Brian and Elisa, I want to just echo what everyone else is saying about what a great presentation that you've brought us. I'm so very glad that you brought it to the county councilors, and I'm pleased that they were listening and hopefully learning. Peggy, did you have something you wanted to add?
No, I was just clapping for a great presentation.
Yeah, it was terrific. Really, really, really good. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
This is Paul, and we're not alone in this fight for the COVID and for climate change. President Biden is having the same problem in D.C. with trying to get through his bills towards these particular interests. But we need to take one step at a time, and we're in the Northwest, and this is where we are and what we've got to do here. So great presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Well, I'll move to the bylaw subcommittee update and review. So I have the opportunity to work with the rest of the bylaws committee. We had, it was a subcommittee. We had Sandy Brown and Michelle Stickley, Dr. Melnick and Roxanne assisted. And I know that in the background, other members of the leadership team had input through them. And we were supported beautifully by Doreen. Our task was to take the new law, the House Bill 1152, and our bylaws and see where we needed to do some alignment so that we will be in harmony with what the law is stating we are now to do. So a little bit of background on this, just for those who might not have, you know, followed it that well. This bill that was written and has now been adopted into law, there's a lot of history about how it came about, which I won't go into right now, but the objective of it was to have better alignment, I think, across the state as far as how our communities have input into what's going on in the public health arena. And one of the things that they wanted in this bill, and it's there, is that if there's a board of health that is made up exclusively of elected officials, and correct me if I get this wrong, Roxanne or Alan, that community, that jurisdiction, has to have what they call the community health, community public health board, I think is what they called it. And we, and so technically we would fulfill that role.
The Community Health Advisory Board.
Advisory Board, thank you. And we talked about changing the name to the words that they're using in the law, but decided that we don't need to do that. In one of the edits that we made in our bylaws is that to just represent that our work as a Public Health Advisory Council will fulfill that role. So we are bound by the parts of the law that say we must do this and we must do that. And you all received it ahead of time, I believe. So you'd have a chance to see it with the edits in place. So so Michelle and Sandy and Dr. Melnick, Roxanne and I and others have had input, put it together as you see it today. It then went to our public health department's attorney, who made a couple of minor changes, and now we're presenting it to you with the hope that we can get a vote on it to approve it, and then we'll have our bylaws updated and they'll be consistent with the law. I'm trying to think if there were any other, first of all, I'll ask, were there questions among you after reading the edited bylaws that you would like to have us address right now?
I have a question about the list of there was a list of the types of folks that should be represented, and can you pull the document up? Can you share it?
I don't actually I don't know that I can do that from here. Okay. Are you able to do that, Doreen?
Which document are you asking about, the bylaws that we adjusted?
With the list of the roles that the law requires.
Let's see. I have the.
So it states that.
Yeah, that's it, Doreen.
Okay.
It talks about the membership.
Yeah, right there.
And that it should represent all geographic areas of the county, urban and rural.
Yes.
I think it was included, and then it was a list of a bulleted list of all the different types of folks that should be that could be represented in or members of the council. And I was just wondering, you have listed like there's not a statement around culturally specific groups except the one about tribal members. And I was wondering, if you're using an equity lens, would you use something, a statement of folks from culturally specific groups, and then list those groups that are disproportionately affected by mental and physical health mm-hmm. inequities, like LGBTQIA, folks with disabilities, BIPOC community, et cetera. I'm just wondering if that should be something more explicit.
I think it's a great question. What the law said was that membership must be diverse, and that's really pretty huge and doesn't really provide detail mm-hmm. at all. So I think that's something that we can still talk about and get some help with as far as the language. Before we didn't have anything like that in the bylaws before. Mm-hmm. So this first attempt was to try to align our current bylaws with the law, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean that we can't make them better. That's what we should be doing.
Hey, Marla, the law says we could flesh this out in the bylaws, but the mm-hmm. law does says communities that experience
yes.
inequities.
Right.
So we could take, you guys are doing the bylaws, but you could take those bylaws and expand on that.
Okay.
If that would work, Shauna.
I think that that's, I guess that gets to, I guess that gets to what I was kind of inquiring about.
Yeah.
And this is Sandy, and when we talk, and we're going to talk about a chart where we put our, or where we represent, and when we were talking about each of those categories as a bylaws committee, we did talk about kind of definitions for each of those categories and what it would include, and I think that gets to that specificity, Shauna, that you're asking about, and, you know, because these are pretty general categories, and we do want to make sure we have a wide representation. And so I think that's a conversation we did start to have about putting some definition and specificity on that. Mm-hmm. And so whether we as a group choose to do that in the bylaws or whether we want to do that on the chart, but that is a good conversation to continue to have.
And so let's maybe go ahead.
I would recommend adding it to the bylaws because that's the most powerful opportunity that we will have to amend language and make a firm statement on where our values lie. We're not going to get this opportunity again soon unless we, you know, include language for, you know, the frequency that we're going to review bylaws, but that makes our priorities very clear in terms of our efforts. So I absolutely think that we need to take every policy opportunity possible to embed language that prioritizes racial equity and makes space and creates power for groups who are disproportionately impacted by mental health and health-based outcomes. So yes, absolutely, I vote for that, even though I'm not a voting member.
I agree. One of the things that we did add
I'm looking at the bylaws now, and up at the very beginning. I don't know, can you scroll up, Doreen? All the way up. Yeah. So now just down a little bit, sorry. And you could just go down, okay, right there. Now, so one of the things that I did take from the law and inserted, I had to paraphrase, but that we would use a health equity framework to conduct, assess, and identify community health needs. And that was just, I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg, but it is what we say we'll do. So I think that if we can, and what you're looking at right now, that ABCD, those are like high level guiding, I call them high level aims. Underneath that is a lot of specificity that the law spelled out for us. And that doesn't mean that we can't add to it. We can't take away from the law. We're bound by that. But we can add to it to make it more relevant to reflect our principles. I completely agree with doing that to the extent possible. And I don't think it's true that we can't update the bylaws as needed. I don't know that there is a barrier to going in and improving them when we see an opportunity to do so. So, because this has gone into effect, we wanted to at least make sure that our bylaws fulfill the requirements in the law. And so that was sort of the first stab at this.
And I think the easiest way to do this, if you wanted to do it relatively, I agree with Andrea that doing it now would be, is to take this part in the law where it says communities that experience inequities, mm-hmm. and I think you can write including but not limited to, or something, some language in there that you make it clear that the membership would include mm-hmm. people with those lived experience and perspectives.
Right. Yeah,
I mean, if you guys want, that would be I don't know. And
well, I think we need to get it in there some way, and I'm just not sure right now. I'd have to really step back and look at it again. But any and would appreciate help from other members if you can help think about how to make this more clear and more consistent with what our values are. That would be helpful because we don't have to vote on this tonight if people are feeling like there's still more work to do. That's why we're bringing it here.
This is Heather. I just had a question around the health equity framework. Mm-hmm. Is this a specified framework that we've selected, or is there a particular framework we're using, and is there something embedded in that framework that would help with ensuring that we have the right approach to ensuring we have diverse members? Because I kind of hear the term health equity framework, and I'm wondering, what is the model? What is the framework that we're going to be utilizing?
Yeah, and I'm not sure there's just one, but I heard that same terminology applied to, you know, various different situations. And I think it calls out the fact that we need to be a lot more inclusive and a lot more thoughtful, you know, going into some of these kinds of, in our guiding principles, so, and not just business as usual, because there's been a lot of opportunity to improve in that area. And I really saw that a lot in my time in healthcare. So
the health equity framework isn't about membership, although getting perspectives, perspectives really helps do that. The health equity framework is about looking at the impact of, for example, the resolution that the Board of Health passed late fall, about racism as a public health crisis, basically looking at determinants of health and the issue that conditions like racism have affect the health of populations, for example, BIPOC populations, and looking at health outcomes and health conditions in that framework. That's just one example, but knowing that some populations have a disproportionate are disproportionately impacted by health threats is something that is, I don't know if I'm explaining it very well, but that's more of a health equity framework.
Mm-hmm. So maybe I could show you there is one thing that you didn't get yet because it was still a work in process, and that was a chart that took these categories that were mentioned in the law and trying to figure out how can we feel comfortable and how can we help ourselves get to where we want to be in terms of our membership. We've talked in, whenever we have an opening, this is a conversation that we have, is how can we increase the diversity in our membership now that we have an opening? And so this chart that you're looking at right now, we didn't have it ready to send it out in advance of the meeting. Sandy did a lot of work on this. And when we thought about looking at the names down the on the left-hand side, many of these names, many of you, could fall into multiple of these categories because many people that are on this committee or on the council serve in many ways in the community and in their role on the Public Health Advisory Council. So the desire was to put this out with the experience and expertise in healthcare and quality and the community members with lived experiences and have people self-identify what you bring to your role on the Public Health Advisory Council rather than try to figure that out. You know what your lived experience is, you know what your work and volunteer and other experiences are. And so that is what we would like to ask of every member so we can see where we have gaps. Because we have never actually assessed it to this level of detail before. And that's part of what we want to start with us and see how are we doing at, having a diverse membership. So that's what we're proposing. Yeah, good statement, Shona.
Yeah, I'm just sharing some language that we've also used as a foundation that whether you want to find a place for it in the bylaws or not, but diversity is such a broad, it could be diversity of profit, it could be diversity of field and interest, but when I'm thinking of health inequities, I'm thinking of this type of diversity.
Exactly.
Specifically.
Yeah. Well, could you send that statement to, or maybe Doreen, can you pick up these comments at the end of the meeting so we don't lose them?
Yep. Absolutely.
And I can support with that as well. And I think there's an opportunity to add some of the descriptors that Shauna just added to the chat, mm-hmm. to this chart, and mm-hmm. then also embed it into the language in terms of prioritizing really how we want back to reflect our community. In that way, and that way we have it everywhere. It should be in terms of prioritizing when we're reading and we're able to speak about what facts they perceive. That's the way to make sure that it's in both places.
Absolutely. So Doreen, will this be sent out? Sounds like we still have some work to do, which is great because I'm glad that we brought it here. We can have the conversation and continue to refine and improve it. But I think this is something that you all need to be able to look at and spend a little time with it and help us also make this work in the context of the rest of the bylaw document. Because we haven't had something like this before.
I do think that we have a timeline on this because I think our new bylaws do need to be in place, if I'm not mistaken, right, by end of year. Is that right?
I think that is right. I'm pretty sure. they have two different dates depending on when some of these communities don't even have a council like this at all. A lot of the language that's in the law came out of our bylaws.
Yeah. So. I think technically, even without doing anything, given that our bylaws, in fact, bylaws were used to create the legislation, mm-hmm. we're probably okay. We need that member. We will need, and I'm not sure the deadline for getting a Board of Health member as an ad hoc member. But I think, I mean, part of the reason for doing these bylaws is to really update them to reflect what's in the legislation, including your new roles, I should say. And I think this is an opportunity in terms of reflecting the legislation to really work on making these other changes as well. I don't think we'll implode if we don't make the changes, but I can't guarantee that. I probably do need to talk to the county attorney about that to be sure.
But if we have till the end of the year and we have, interested folks to help us finish this, I don't think that we'll have a problem getting it done by then.
Marla, how many members are there currently?
It's a small group. We just have Sandy and myself.
I mean, in all of FAC.
Oh, there's 20 people right now, I believe. Are there 20, Doreen?
Well, yes. Well, we have 19, and we're waiting on our 20th, which is the City of Vancouver rep.
Mm-hmm. And is the group, is something we can consider as adding additional categories so that we would have a larger group? Is that something people feel okay with?
The limit in the statute is 21.
It's limited to 21.
Yeah, it has to be at least 9, and it can be as many as 21.
Got it.
We may be able also, if we want to put a deadline in place for feedback from FAC, we could possibly put this in a shared, like a Google Drive or something mm-hmm. that you all have access to. And then you can put your comments in, and then maybe what the the bylaws committee could go back and take a look at those changes. Incorporate those, and then we can do another view, have our attorney do another view of those just to make sure there's no, I can't imagine that there'd be any issues, but it's always good to have the last look, and then we could bring it back to the next FAC meeting again to take a look if that sounds okay to you all. Is that a good process? Okay.
Doreen, can we do that? Could we easily put it like on Google Drive or whatever it's called, Google Docs?
I haven't personally used that, but I can look into it. I imagine I could figure it out.
I think there's different, there's like Dropbox and there's some others. So we can certainly do that research and figure out what's best for the group and drop it into, and they're very easy to use. You just go in there and we give you editing rights. You can go in there and you can make comments and then it shows up. And a lot of times too, if multiple people are in there at once, that's okay. It doesn't shut the document down, which is also helpful. And then we can also have some kind of real-time conversation as well. So we can certainly look into that and get that out to you all. And anybody that would be interested in making any comments, I think that's great. I love what Shona put into the chat box, and I definitely think we can incorporate that language. I think it's excellent.
Agreed. And I have used shared directories to try to work on a journal article and different things. And the thing with that is it kind of gets tricky with version control. So I think we'll just, I might need some help to manage it so that it doesn't get, too confusing. But I love the idea of having people be involved in constructing the language for this. And because there were only three of us plus Ellen and Doreen and Roxanne, if someone else wants to at this point in time join us and help refine and improve this language, we certainly could use some additional hands and help. So give that some thought. And we mostly have worked on it. We've worked on it on our own, and then we come together, and then we've worked on it on our own. So it actually hasn't been a ton of time yet I too was kind of under the operating theory that we had a deadline that we had to meet and wanted to make sure that we got that done, and that we, with the belief that we could continue to, I think something like this should not really be something that goes on the shelf and is never looked at for 3 or 4 years.
And the other alternative is to inundate us with edits and comments and send them to us directly. Michelle will really like that. But you know, I think we can get this done before January. I'm optimistic.
One thing I found was when it came to me and it was in a PDF form, I had to go to Google Docs to change it back into a Word, and then I made my changes, and then I had to change it back. And there's, you can lose some things in the translation. So, but I would love to get some more feedback from our council. So we'll get that done. So, and so we'll get this, so Jereen, you'll send out this chart so people can look at it and think about where the many places that they probably can fit into there.
But, you know, as we change the bylaws there and have some categories there, we might want to change the chart. I mean, the chart isn't in the bylaws, so it's not as critical, but I think we'll, at some point, we'll want to change the chart to address what's the changing in the bylaws.
Exactly. But it's something to look at. So hopefully that helps start getting people thinking. So I think maybe what I'll do is move us on. And so we've got some work to do, which is a good thing. It's better to get it done well than get it done fast, in my opinion. Well, let's go on to, we got Jeff's budget update. And Anne-Marie is going to talk about what's going on with racial equity training update.
Hi, good evening, everyone. I have a brief update on our attempt to secure American Rescue Act funds to set up a learning collaborative for our leadership and management team. So we submitted our staff report back in early September, $150,000 request to contract out for learning collaborative services specifically focused around racial equity in the intersection of public health discipline and practice to help inform our leadership and managers such that we could be good stewards of embedding the principles and dismantling racism such that it embeds kind of front to back, up, down, left, and right of what the future of our practice looks like, especially as you know, the research and the conversations and the dialogue continue to evolve. So we submitted that request. The request was denied on the grounds of that the county is going to send out a similar request for services or RFP. And knowing that likely what the county is going to send out is not necessarily going to align with our internal public health related needs in terms of what we hope to learn and take away from a public health perspective as it relates to our anti-racist initiative, we kind of came back to the drawing board with our equity, diversity, and inclusion group. So it's an internal work group that we have. And so they've been doing some historical work for the past 2 years. And so rather than kind of give up on the effort altogether, which is not an option, we're thinking of creative ways that we can still embed learning using free webinars and services that are available, and really working with the leadership team in EDIG to figure out, okay, what content do we want to consume? How do we want to facilitate these dialogues? What do we really want managers to walk away with? And so the first step in that, we're going to convene our leadership team and our EDIG team members in November. Took a while to kind of reconcile schedules, but so the first kind of set of materials or webinar that we're going to review is the APHA, the American American Public Health Association. They did this amazing 6-part webinar series on advancing racial equity, and I thought it to be fantastic. And so I really wanted to share it with the EDIG work group and say, hey, what are your thoughts? What are your takeaways? Would this be a direction we could go? They're free. You can consume them. There's PowerPoints. A lot of resources that come out of that engage critical thinking and dialogue practice measures, policy-related information, and so really getting kind of a pulse check on if this group thinks that this would be a good direction we could go. And, for example, to kind of tie back to our earlier conversations on climate change and environmental justice, the sixth webinar is really dedicated to environmental justice, right? There's a birth outcome webinar, right? And this disproportionate impact of maternal child health mortality rates by race. So really good stuff. We're going to start there, and if EDIG really feels like these are the set of materials we want to begin with, then we will have an ongoing dialogue about what and who is best to facilitate those conversations, and again, really focusing on training and building up baseline knowledge in our leadership teams and our management teams, such that then we could be good stewards of holding ourselves accountable for what learning looks like for all of our staff. Set some goals and some timelines up for that, and then move forward. We really want the process to be collaborative in terms of considering which materials we consume, now that we're doing this without like a formal guided plan. I know that Dr. Melnick has had an amazing opportunity to participate as part of a racial equity learning collaborative with a couple of our staff, and that's what we were going to try to parallel. And so now, knowing that we weren't necessarily funded for this round, what can we do in the meantime while we wait for the county to go through their RFP processes and hopefully ideally dovetail those initiatives with the concept and idea that the more learning we do, the better. So that is the overarching update. It's like Dr. Melnick dropped that series in the chat. And if you have time, each webinar, it's about an hour and a half, good resources attached to the end of each of those. So that's where we're going to begin. In the event that the group decides, hey, this is not really the direction and the set of materials we want to use to move forward, then we'll reassess our utilization of other free materials to begin our journey. And our kind of, it's going to be a more of a self-guided, self-taught plan. And I think it will be, and it can be just as effective. I just wanted to thank Dr. Melnick for really articulating one of our top three priorities internally as our commitment to racial equity. So that for me helps us to make space and make room for the dialogue and prioritize it amid, a lot of competing interests and things that are happening in the community. So that's my update. Does anybody have any questions?
Thank you for giving us some ideas of what you're thinking about doing, and it sounds like those things might be accessible and available. Could you send some of that information? I think we could put it in our minutes or something so that those of us who have the time and interest can go and look at some of these materials now and get familiar with them, because I'm not familiar with them.
Absolutely, and Dorian and I have the opportunity to work together as part of EDIG, so we can absolutely make sure that those are embedded into the minutes, and we'll get those out to you for sure.
You can get continuing education credits for watching the webinars as well. I'll throw that thing in there. Sorry.
And will this training be for just the public health management and leadership folks, or will it be more widespread? Is it something that FAC members could participate in if they, sounds like if it's good material and it can be done by individuals, although personally I think I've been most impacted myself personally by doing, had an excellent training with the Healthy Living Collaborative where it wasn't really, didn't feel like a training, it felt like really being in an experience where, I felt very vulnerable and I felt very enlightened, and it was enriching, and I felt like I didn't even need that training, but I came away from there feeling like I had a lot of new sensitivities, understanding, and appreciation. So that's the only thing, if you're doing it all by yourself, you don't get that part, but maybe there's a way of starting with the materials that we can access and that we can have access to, and then eventually maybe add some additional experience that is maybe a little bit more personally impactful.
Absolutely, and I would argue that it will always be a both and. Continuing a lifetime
worth of research and reading and self-reflection and dialogue. Dialogue is incredibly critical to the process because vulnerability, understanding your privileges, how you know your biases, unconscious and conscious, inform decision making, structure, systems, all of that.
Yeah.
Right? And in order to really make change and understand where you have power to impact change, that has to be part of the dialogue.
Yeah.
And those are, and so to answer your original question, we really want to begin making sure that our leadership and managers have a foundational understanding and can navigate the conversations and have the hard conversations, understand where they occupy power and privilege such that they are making space and holding space for those conversations once we start expanding what education and trainings and webinars look like for all staff, but absolutely. So I would love for FAC to be a part of this dialogue and a journey. I know that maybe we can have a conversation with leadership to figure out the logistics of how best that could work, handing over the keys in terms of the driver's seat to EDIG to help us inform what, how, who, when, and distribute the power that way. And then we can come back with an update to FAC as appropriate and as desired. I'd love to make this just a brief standing agenda item or, you know, schedule viewing here. There's a lot of different things that I think we can do. And given, you know, the resolution that Dr. Melnick mentioned earlier, declaring racism as a public health crisis, I think it's really important to center it kind of as the lens for a lot of, if not all, of the dialogue we're having.
It's a great start. Thank you. Thanks, Andrea. Okay, then I think the next thing is we are all going to have a conversation with you, Dr. Melnick, about council members, what their experience as far as barriers and issues that we're facing related to COVID-19.
So, yeah, I wasn't planning on doing a presentation this time. I think you've heard me being a talking head probably enough. I'm happy to answer questions people might have. There will be a Board of Health meeting tomorrow at 9, where I will be giving an update on COVID-19 to them. You're all welcome not only to listen in, but to testify as well. There is public testimony on that. So the idea of this is to have a conversation with FAC members about their barriers, issues you're facing around COVID-19. And I'll shut up there.
Well, I'll start, I guess. I believe that in Washington and Oregon that the governors have declared that all people vaccinated or not, when indoor settings, when they're indoors, will wear masks. And it's clearly not happening. Some places it's maybe 50-50, and some places, you know, it's not. Not at all. Is there any intention around enforcing any of that? Is it just lip service, or can you speak about, is that really something that's an expectation, or was it just a good thing to say?
Are you asking me?
Yes.
That is a great question, because it's come up. We were just talking about this in leadership team today. So, and I'll let any of my team members, I think it's Roxanne and I and Janice are still on. Andrea had to get off. So that is part of the issue. Like, so if you're at a gathering indoors, or even at a business or something, you know, how is that enforced? How is a mask mandate enforced? And what is public health's role in that? Because to be able to enforce something, I have to have we basically have the resources to be able to go in there and be the, I guess, you know, the mask enforcers. And that is really something that we don't have the resources or capability of doing. It really rely on partners. So we rely on the businesses to do that and the venues to do that. You can certainly people can certainly, there's a way to complain to the governor's office about a business or, you know, a venue that's not following that. But there are real challenges, you know, the chief challenges around, given the number of potential venues and where all this is happening, that we don't have the ability to, or the resources to enforce it ourselves. We really do rely on the businesses, you know, in terms of their employees and their workers, they have to follow the labor and industry guidelines. But in terms of the public, let's say a public setting, those are governor's mandates that we really rely on the public to behave, as well as the settings to make sure that happens. I don't know, Roxanne, you look like, are you wanting to say something? Or there's a challenge to us. We don't have the bandwidth or the resources. I can't go in and, what am I going to do as, you know, like the health officer to address that?
Well,
but when you see something, when you see something going on, you can make a complaint, whether anything, I mean, here's some of the challenges we're dealing with. Talking some of the school districts, you know, the if you have more than 500 people in a outdoor setting, you know, like a football game or something, masks are required. But if you're under 500, masks are not required. So some venues around the state are limiting attendance to 499, so they can take the masks off. That's the kind of, and now I'm talking too much. You guys are all supposed to talk, but those are the kinds of challenges we're facing.
Mm-hmm. The only other thing I would add is that the governor is, there's a specific, and we can drop that in the notes as well, but there's a site that you can go to and lodge complaints. You know, if you have any, if there are complaints about venues like this, there's a specific place that the governor is taking that commentary, and I think that's super important because, again, just like what we were talking about our board of counselors, you know, if the governor doesn't hear that there are these issues, then he and his office may not take any further action. But the more they know that the guidance isn't being followed across the state, I think the more information he has to make decisions about next steps. So we would definitely encourage people that have issues or want to make some complaints to make sure that they also go to that site and put some information in there.
Yeah, I don't think it should come to local jurisdictions. It was a statewide mandate. I think it should go to the governor's office.
You know, you might also notice that there's no restrictions on gatherings anymore. Remember last summer when the rates were a fraction of what they are now in terms of case rates? We had, remember, phase two and phase three and all that. That all we got is, you know, you can have any size gathering, but if there's more than 500 outdoors, you have to wear masks. And you can have any size gathering indoors, basically, but you have to wear masks. But remember the restrictions last summer?
Yeah. I
don't exist anymore.
Well, what other issues are people encountering, or are you encountering any?
I was wondering about flu shots, Ellen. Is there gonna be a push to get people's flu shots?
We just got some information out. We put out a press release today about encouraging people to get flu shots.
I got mine
today. I got shots in both arms. I got COVID booster, and I got the flu shot in the other arm. So
we're not all supposed to get the booster, right? Are we? Or we're not?
No, only people who are either 65 and older, or people who are 18 and older of certain underlying medical conditions, and people who are 18 and older and working in higher risk settings.
Okay.
So we can get you all the list on that.
I got my booster yesterday. This is Paul. and I got my flu shot last month. So I'm well, and I wanted to point out one of the things which we were talking about just a few minutes ago about the mask. I work at Huber's in downtown Portland. I've not had any issues with people coming in. We have masks available if they don't have it in order to enter. They also have to have them on if they get up to, say, go to the restroom or something. Haven't had any major issues, but people sometimes forget. And I did notice yesterday I was in Walmart here locally, and they had someone standing at the door with masks and giving them to people as they came in to Walmart. So there are certain places that are doing this, and I haven't found, and particularly at Huber's, we get people from out of the state, we get people from out of the country, and haven't really encountered any major problems with anyone as far as that's concerned. Of course, the thing about it is we don't have this thing with social distancing anymore, which is seems to be a problem also, because you have people sitting at tables when they get ready to eat or drink, they take their masks off, so you've got everybody sitting around at a table or at the bar who are not social distance but have their masks off. All the employees are required to wear a mask at all times. So there's still a few holes in this whole thing as far as the mask is concerned, but I just thought I would throw that in.
I just want to add some couple of things about the booster, because I want to make sure everybody gets this right. The booster is only indicated for people who got the Pfizer vaccine. It's for 6 months after your second dose. There's also a recommendation for, and I assume, I think at some point we'll be hearing in the next few weeks or month about booster for Moderna and the J&J vaccine, but they're not indicated yet. A third dose of either of the mRNA vaccines is recommended for people who are immunocompromised, people with immune deficiencies. That's a third dose, and if you got the third dose needs to be given at least 28 days after the second dose in those folks. And that's, if you've gotten the Moderna for the first two, you should get Moderna for the third. Same thing with Pfizer. So I just want to make sure folks know that I got that information. The other thing that businesses can do, and Paul, I appreciate, is, and this is up to the business because there's no mandate on that, is to require proof of vaccination as well. It doesn't completely eliminate the risk, but that's something that businesses can consider.
Well, I find that many restaurants are doing that. However, we don't, and which bothers me considerably, but I would love that if every restaurant required proof or that they had been tested within the last few days. That'd be a requirement, but haven't had any kind of a mandate by the governors of either Washington or Oregon.
Right.
But it would be great to have that. I think that that would simplify things a lot, because there are some people that I have talked to that come into the restaurant that say that they will not get a vaccine. And, you know, we have no control over that. And so that becomes a big issue as far as I'm concerned. But if we made a mandate that you had to have your vaccine card to show that, that would help simplify things, and we'd be able to move forward on that.
That would be helpful.
Are we expecting a big flu season? Sorry to go back to flu.
Yeah, at this point I can't. No, it's okay to go back to flu. That's, I think some of the concerns we have in terms of getting people vaccinated for COVID is flu and COVID are not a good combination. We already got RSV. which is also not a good combination. So, like I said, even though we didn't have much of a flu season at all last year, I was begging people to get the flu shots last fall, and not a good combination. And right now the COVID rates are dropping, but they're still basically as high as they were at the height, at the peak of our last big wave last winter. And we have still a large susceptible population. Hard to predict the flu season. I mean, it could very well be that the masking and the distancing measures that were in effect last year actually put a damper on the flu season.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to predict what it's going to be like this year, but I would urge all of you, everybody 6 months of age and older, to get flu vaccine.
Are they free? I used my insurance card, so I wasn't sure what to tell people.
They may be free in some locations, but insurance covers it. I assume, throw them under the bus, you could probably go to the free clinic. I don't know if we have a listing on our website about flu vaccine locations.
I belong to Kaiser, and mine's free. I got the COVID and the flu shots free. Of course, I pay Kaiser, so that it all depends on how you look at the approach for being free or not.
Yeah, so does Blue Cross Blue Shield. I got mine free, at Walgreens. At QFC, I just walked in. There was no way.
One of the things that I noticed when I was going in there were some people getting both shots at the same time. Mine was separated by a week. But many of the people were getting their flu and their COVID shots at the same time.
I think Peggy has her hand up, and then Tyler.
So I have a question. You know, next week we're coming up on October 18th, which is the deadline for state employees, school employees to be vaccinated. It's my understanding that some school districts are handing out religious exemptions like candy, and I'm interested to know if there are requirements for those school district employees to do testing. Are they still going, if they have a religious exemption, are they still going to be allowed to be around other staff and students, or do we know?
I can't recall whether it's up to the school district or not, but I believe they are going to be requiring testing for employees, who use a religious exemption. And I've recommended to them that they do a twice a week instead of once a week. I think, I don't think once a week is often enough. I believe that's part of the accommodation that, you have to accommodate people with a religious exemption. And I believe that's part of it, including, masking as well. I'll have to look that one up for you.
I know our school district, if you have the religious exemption, they're requiring 2 times a week testing in Ridgefield.
That's going to be, by the way, I completely support that, and I believe that's what the school districts are going to do. That's going to be a huge expense for the school districts. I know the county has been looking at that as well. And I think even once a week for the county, it was large government, was, I think, $75,000 and up a week. I mean, it's going to be thousands of dollars a week. And then it's, the tracking and the workforce involved to be tracking all that. So that's going to be pricey. And then the other issue is, concerns me, is that testing supplies are limited. The other thing I would recommend, that I've recommended to the schools, is don't rely on in-home testing, because you can't be sure that the specimen is actually on the person who's got the exemption. And if they're doing the test results at home, you can't rely on that as well. So there's other challenges with that, including testing supplies and costs. Tyler's got his hands up.
Yeah, Tyler.
Yeah, well, just going back to the original question about barriers and issues that we've been experiencing, and what I want to talk about, I guess, is a total different conversation here a little bit, but more related to issues with youth athletics, I guess, and opportunities for youth athletics that are right now. So, I see youth athletics is something that's extremely important for both physical health and mental health for kids. I saw my kids struggle for, you know, over a year where there were no opportunities whatsoever for athletics. And now there are some opportunities for some people, but not for others. And as we transition from what is a current fall and summer sports time when kids actually do have opportunities for outdoors and transition to more indoor type sports like basketball and wrestling and things like that, there are not opportunities right now for that. Kids just don't have, or the school districts aren't renting spaces. They're not allowing, whether it's the Boys and Girls Club or Hot Shots or all these other programs that are out there, they're not getting space for kids to be able to have athletic opportunities. And I just see it going back to where kids are just struggling again. And there are some kids, if you're in high school or middle school, where there are sports opportunities for kids through their schools, those opportunities don't exist for the elementary school age kids. So it's just kind of something that I've been experiencing lately where kids just, we just can't get gym space for different youth athletics, and it's just been a problem. So just wanted to bring that up.
Dr. Melnick, have you heard anything about that? Is there any kind of a plan for how to address that issue?
Well, there are guidelines on I'm trying to remember the athletic, so, you know, state guidelines in terms of sports, and I can share that with all of you, and hopefully the schools are following that. I mean, there are challenges here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, it also gets down to human behavior as well. There was, you know, more recently we had a football team that was where there was transmission, and we had to quarantine that football team. And it was probably because of some of the behaviors that were going on in the locker room where people weren't masking and were close, not physically distant. So there are guidelines in terms of doing it safely, you know, more safely, but it is challenging. And, you know, we all want kids to be back in school. I think, you know, I'm looking, I wish we, the other thing I'd point out, and, you know, it's not, you know, it's unfortunately athletics get tainted with this because, you know, kids get out of school, even if the schools are operating safely, they get out of school and then they're all commiserating with each other or not practicing physical distancing and masking. You know, at private gatherings where they are, the rates, the biggest increases in COVID rates are in adolescents and young adults right now, case rates. And, you know, and also the vaccination rates for adolescents is, even though they're, you know, 12 and above are eligible, are much lower compared to older populations. You know, at the end of this month, you know, the FDA and the CDC advisory committees are going to be meeting about the vaccination for 5 to 11 year olds. And, you know, the stuff that I'm reading is that we'll be lucky if, you know, and hopefully they'll be released, you know, that'll be available in November. We'll be lucky if 30% or so of kids get vaccinated. I have concerns about that. I mean, we need to be really encouraging vaccination for kids. The health officers across the state had we discussed whether vaccination should be mandatory, just like, by the way, I'm sorry, I'm trying to go on as quickly as I can. We require chickenpox vaccine, you know, varicella vaccine for schools. COVID-19 in adolescents has a higher mortality rate than chickenpox, and the Delta variant is as contagious as chickenpox. Yet we're going to see all kinds of barriers to making COVID-19 vaccine required for school. I'm saying the health officers got together and talked about this, and we're basically not going to recommend a mandated for school entry at this time, where, because we don't have full FDA approval, you know, I'm going to be dealing with issues around the EUA. It'll be an emergency use authorization for 5 to 11 year olds, and we're going to want to wait a little bit longer to see how that works out. But whatever we can do to encourage parents to get their kids vaccinated, I think will be really helpful as well in terms of,
you know, getting schools, making, you know, sure that schools are operating safely. Mm-hmm. Sorry for all that. I can talk about this for hours.
I think that's really an important point, and you know, we can do what we can in our own little circle of friends and family, and but I'm going to move us on now because we're almost up on the hour. It's almost 7:30. My executive committee update is relating to our nominations for our officers for next year, and it's that time of year. And so we will need to have a group come together prior to our December 14th meeting to come up with a slate of officers. And we would like to have three members for a nominating committee. And if you are interested in serving as an officer, please let Doreen know, email her or call her. And also, let her know if you'd be interested in helping serve as a member of the nominating committee. And if you could do that as soon as possible, that would be great. If we could get three members, that would be very helpful. So the officers are the executive committee, a chair, a vice chair, and then a member at large. And all three of the officers are rotating off at the end of this. Well, it'll actually happen. What will happen next is that we would present this slate of officers that were suggested to the members at our, I believe it's at the December meeting, is that right, Doreen? And then in February is when we would vote. So that's why this has to all happen right now, pretty soon. So please, if you have it usually doesn't take a lot of time to come up with a list, and especially if you'd be interested in serving as an officer, please let Doreen know. Okay, that's all I have. Our next meeting is December 14th. Don't know yet what the format will be. I'm kind of suspecting, given everything that's going on, it might still be by Zoom, but I don't think that's been finally decided yet, unless you know something more about that, Roxanne, do you? Okay, well, we'll wait and see. And does anyone have any words to share as for the good of the order before we conclude? Hearing none, then I would ask someone if they would, do I even need to? I think I could just close the meeting. We're up on the time. Okay. Well, then I'm going to say good night, and I hope you have a good evening, and look forward to seeing you all on December 14th. Thank you, everyone, for all your great comments.
Thank you. Thank you, Marla. Good meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.